I really wasn't expecting anything. I was just waiting on my name to be called at the end of the day. You know, the Steelers did what they could to get me, so I'm happy with what happened.
Yes, and so am I. That's Broderick Jones, the Steelers' new first-round draft choice. I'm Tim Benz. This is the Pittsburgh CityCast. It's brought to you by Bet Rivers. Bet now from anywhere. Download the app today or go to betrivers.com. We have a ton to get to today. We need to investigate the lines for Rays and Pirates coming up tonight for game one of that. Am I about to say this? Much-anticipated series. We will do so and get some analysis from Jay Retcher of WDAE in Tampa as well. We have to analyze the lines for the upcoming second round of the NHL playoffs. We're going to get into all that with Brian Metzer of the Penguins Radio Network. But first, let's recap the draft. Georgia offensive tackle Broderick Jones is the guy I wanted the Steelers to select in the first round for a while. You know that if you listen to this podcast. You know that if you read me at Trib Live. You know that if you listen to me on the radio here in Pittsburgh. I wasn't sure if he'd be on the board when the team was originally supposed to pick at 17. I wasn't sure that they'd be able to trade up for him if the organization wanted to do so, which is why the circumstances that eventually led to the Steelers drafting him on Thursday are almost as delicious as the selection itself. First of all, the Steelers got help from, of all teams, the Patriots. Yes, those New England Patriots. I mean, obviously, right? I mean, when the Steelers are in the hour of need that they were in for the draft, and who else are they going to turn to aside from old pal Bill Belichick and their friends in Foxborough, am I right? It was New England that traded with Pittsburgh to move back to 17 from 14, so the Steelers moved up three slots to eventually select Jones, one spot ahead of New England's AFC East rivals, the New York Jets, the same Jets who allegedly coveted a tackle and had an interest in Jones. Think that was a coincidence? No, neither do I. How about you, Mike Tomlin?
We had a high level of preparedness. Obviously, we weren't willing to mortgage anything above a third-day pick. He got within range. There had been a run at his position. There were some teams potentially in front of us that may have had an interest in the position. It was a player that we coveted, and so we did what we needed to do to secure the player that we identified.
Also helping the Steelers was that New York had dropped behind the Patriots in the first place by virtue of flipping picks with the Green Bay Packers in the Aaron Rodgers trade. So Green Bay took 13th. They took Lucas Van Ness, and the Jets were sitting around at 15 waiting to see what the Patriots were going to do, and the Steelers were at 17 making a deal with the Patriots. Another reason to celebrate the Jones selection is that the Steelers only had to toss in a fourth-round pick, number 120, along with swapping first-round selections with New England to get the deal done. And actually, come to think of it, I bet Belichick enjoyed messing with the Jets so much, the Patriots should have given the Steelers a fourth-rounder, not the other way around. Here's General Manager Omar Khan after the selection of Broderick Jones.
You know, we were prepared with what we believe clubs behind us and in front of us were interested in what their needs are, and you know, it just sort of worked out. You know, it was more about us really wanting the player. You know, we found somebody that was willing to trade and at the value that we were comfortable with.
Further aiding the Steelers' cause is that there was a run on quarterbacks and running backs. And having selected Kenny Pickett and Najee Harris in the first round of the previous two drafts, there was no way the Steelers were going to take a player from either of those position pools. Five of the top 12 picks were players at those two positions that pushed a number of the offensive tackles and cornerbacks down the board. Darnell Harris going at 11, a tackle that a lot of people thought might be around in, say, pick 12 to 20. That aided the Steelers, so Broderick Jones was still on the board. Those are the Steelers' primary positions of need, cornerbacks and tackles. So even if the franchise couldn't pull off a trade to secure Jones, they could have had their pick of Christian Gonzalez, eventually taken by New England, Joey Porter Jr., Emmanuel Forbes, and Deontay Banks, four cornerbacks believed to have been on the Steelers' radar. One of them, Porter, the Steelers took in the second round anyway, and I want to talk about that a little bit too. Another reason why I like this draft so much, not only because they got the guy I wanted in the first place in Jones, but they got Porter in the second round. Now, Porter might not see it this way, But the fact that he slipped to the second round is going to wind up being a blessing in disguise for him and for the Steelers. I mean, come on, we all heard it. I admit it. I thought about it in recent months. I talked about it in recent months. Are the Steelers really going to take Joey Porter Jr. in the first round because he's the son of a former All-Pro with the team and a son of one of Mike Tomlin's former assistant coaches? Are they really just going to take Joey Porter Jr. because of the lineage? It would have been intentionally ignorant to ignore that as a point of deliberation in advance of the first round. But it also would have been unfair to assume. Unfair to Porter and unfair to the team. After all, most draft boards had Porter rated third or fourth among cornerbacks. Everybody knew the Steelers needed a corner. So based on draft prognostications, if Porter had been there at 17 when the Steelers selected, that should have been viewed as a logical fit regardless of concerns about NFL nepotism. But then all the corners slipped. Just one, Witherspoon, went to Seattle at pick number 5. And Jones was still available. So the Steelers traded up to 14. And if the Steelers had taken Porter there and left Jones and Gonzalez on the board, then the cronyism talk would have gone into high gear. Like, really high gear. Heck, if they had stayed at 17 and Gonzalez and Jones were both gone and they had taken Porter over Banks or Forbes, they still might have gotten some of it. Porter then wouldn't have just been scrutinized as an NFL rookie playing one of the most difficult positions in the field. He would also have been the player the Steelers took just because he's Peasy's kid, especially if Jones and Gonzalez had gone on to big things with other teams. Based on how things played out, the nepotism theory, though, is severely dented. It's one less stress for Porter to endure as a rookie and throughout his whole career, to be honest. The Steelers actively traded up to get somebody else while Porter was still available. Every team with a draft pick had a chance to select him, and there he was, still to open up day two. As a result, Joey Porter Jr. can just play football. He actually has become now a draft choice that's perceived to have a little extra value by falling to the second round, as opposed to being someone who would have inevitably been painted as overvalued by a franchise that just couldn't say no to the romantic storyline. It was a story with all the touchy-feely vibes in the world, and it could have been spun sour on day one. However, under the circumstances, it feels like we can embrace the little circle of life angle here because every other franchise had a chance to get him, and he's a Steeler anyway, and the Steelers got great value with their first-round pick. So I look at it this way. If I had hopped in a black and gold time machine a week before the draft and then returned before the Steelers' selection of the first round and said, I have been to the future. And after 32 picks, the Steelers will have drafted both Broderick Jones and Joey Porter, and it only cost a fourth rounder, well, we all would have celebrated like crazy. The Steelers and the way the front office went about making this happen, with a little help from the draft board and the Patriots, that certainly helps. Not only from the standpoint of dimming the spotlight on Porter, but honestly, it dims the spotlight on Tomlin and his reasons for how the draft shook out, and Khan as he goes through his first draft as a general manager. You know, the quickest distance between two points is always a straight line. A first-round pick of Porter coming to the Steelers might have been the most direct, but sometimes a circuitous route is a little bit more scenic. And my bet is the way that's how things turn out for Porter Jr. with the Steelers. Again, to say nothing of them getting Broderick Jones in the first place, which I just love. Now, beyond that, the team's other second-round selection, Keanu Benton, the Wisconsin defensive lineman, good run stuffer in college. And the team seems to think that Menton could play either nose or the Cam Hayward, Larry Ogunjobi spots on the end. That means he can also push the pocket up the middle and get after the passer some. He did have 4.5 sacks last year. Benton sounds satisfied to bounce up and down the line. I think he's likely to become more of what Javon Hargrave was by the time he left Pittsburgh than he is Cam Hayward, but I'll take that because I wish they kept Hargrave. Now, after a trade down, they got third-round tight end Darnell Washington from Georgia. He profiles as an excellent blocker who can also catch 6'7", 265. He could practically serve as an offensive lineman when the Steelers need to load up in a jumbo package. Number zero is reporting eligible, even though he doesn't have to. I can see the Mount Washington shirts in the Strip District now. The fourth round choice, Nick Herbig, brother of Nate Herbig, the newly signed offensive lineman for the Steelers. He also played on Wisconsin's defense like Benton did. Pass rusher, 11 sacks last year, one of only six players in college football to reach that number. 6'2", 240. That's a little smaller than the usual outside linebacker for the Steelers, 3'4". Like Malik Reed was on the left side when T.J. Watt got hurt last year. He's 6'2", 235, and he got swallowed up at times. Now, there's been a presumption by some in the Steelers media that eventually Herbig will be moved inside, and maybe he will. Maybe he can contribute in both spots and use his pass rushing skills up the middle, but that's not his immediate future. Sticking at number 80 in the third round, had they not made the trade for Darnell Washington, it's kind of funny how that might have turned out. And if I got something to second guess at all, maybe it's two things. Maybe it's, should they have traded the number one in the second round to get a first round choice next year? Could that have been possible? And if it is possible, do they turn it down? Will we hear stories about that eventually? Maybe not. Probably not. I think they would have done that, but we'll see. That's stuff that usually comes out long after the draft. But sticking at number 80 in the third round, they could have taken Trenton Simpson. That would have made a ton of sense. The Ravens got him instead at number 83. He's the inside linebacker from Clemson. I liked him. That's who I was eyeballing as that number 80 selection came around, and I thought maybe the Steelers, had they been in that spot, could have taken him and groomed him to be a potential starter after Landon Roberts leaves in a year or two. Although trading down with the Panthers and getting an interesting piece like Washington at 93 and Herbig with the additional fourth round selection that they wouldn't have had because of the trade to get Jones, that might make up for it. And then there's the seventh rounders, the huge corner, Corey Trice, and the versatile lineman, Spencer Anderson. Those guys might be useful diamonds in the rough someday as well. Okay, those are my thoughts on the draft. Now on to the Pirates and the Rays. It's the interleague showdown everyone around Major League Baseball has been eagerly anticipating since, well, maybe the third week of April. Sure, the Pirates versus the Rays in Florida starting Tuesday night. Probably wasn't circled on a lot of calendars to start the season. It's getting lots of attention league-wide now, though. Pirates 20-9, best record in the NL. Tampa 23-6, best record in Major League Baseball. A World Series preview, perhaps. It's a little bit too early for that, especially for a Pirates team that lost 100 games in each of the past two seasons and hasn't finished above last place, or at least a tie for last place in the NL Central since 2018. Early season success in 2023, that's less stunning for the Rays. They've been a playoff team for 4 years in a row, winning 79% of their games, though, to this point. That's impressive, but probably even impressive to anyone who thought they were going to be good. It's tough to find something with the Rays that they're not doing well. If you look at what they were doing, entering play on Monday, 61 home runs, leading Major League Baseball. Tops in OPS, 879. Tops in runs scored in Major League Baseball and hits, 195 and 282 respectively. Tops in team batting average at 281. Pitching-wise, the Rays have allowed just 92 runs, fewest in the majors. Only allowed 19 homers, fewest in the majors. 310 for a team ERA, lowest in the majors. A team batting average against of 209, also best in the majors. Knowing all that, being 17 games over 500 makes a little bit more sense. For the Pirates, the balance between hitting and pitching has been similar to that of Tampa's. Again, entering MLB play on Monday night, Pittsburgh's 19 quality starts, the most in baseball, 355 team ERA, sixth. Their 23 home runs allowed, fourth fewest in Major League Baseball. Hitting-wise, Pirates have a team batting average of 264, fifth in MLB. Their OPS is third at 792, and they're fifth in runs at 156. So very impressive, maybe not to the same level as Tampa, but very impressive, the balance between pitching and hitting nonetheless. Both teams have gotten solid bullpen work. Pirates tops in Major League Baseball, 13 saves and 16 opportunities. The Rays have only needed 7 save attempts overall. They finished 5 of them. A bullpen-wide ERA of 297, tied for third. The Pirates' bullpen ERA, 310, second best in the National League. So it's tough to find a soft spot in the Pirates' performance thus far either. They could be a little cleaner in the field. 18 errors, only the Giants with 20, and the Rockies and A's with 21 have more. And if you really want to get picky, neither the Pirates nor the Rays have played a very good schedule. Tampa Bay's opposing winning percentage is .482. That's 19th in Major League Baseball. The Pirates' opposing strength of schedule is .476. That's 21st in Major League Baseball. But now they play each other. Pirates are +220 underdogs to win the best of three series. The Rays are -295. I like the Rays to win two or three, but not at that price, so I'll leave that alone. If I change my mind and do bet it, I'm taking the Bucks at +220. Josh Fleming had been scheduled to pitch the opening game of the series, but now an opener in Javi Guerra, he's going to be on the mound, so that game temporarily off the board at Bet Rivers, at least at the time that we're speaking. Ransy Contreras starts for the Bucks tonight. Shane McClanahan on the mound tomorrow for Tampa. If you're going to bet, I'd bet on the Buccos tonight. If you want to bet on the Pirates, and I'd stay off of them tomorrow against McClanahan, then make up your mind Thursday. Zach Eflin and Vince Velasquez. The Pirates are still +750 to win the division despite the torrid start. Still behind the Cardinals at +350 and the Cubs at +475. The Pirates 29. The Cardinals last place at 10-19, so obviously no one thinks the Pirates' start is real, and no one thinks the slow start of the Cardinals is real either, I guess. The Bucks, they may fade. I don't see the Cardinals heating up to the degree that they win the pennant, though. The Brewers are favored at -137. That might make the most sense. I just don't like it at minus money. I wouldn't put a dollar down on any of those teams right now, but given the odds, frankly, if I'm going to, I'm going to be tempted by the Pirates with the home run number. But let's get the thoughts of Jay Retcher of WDAE Radio in Tampa right now. He joined me on the Breakfast with Ben's podcast, and this is what he had to say about the state of the Rays as the Pirates come to town and play Tampa for an interesting three-game set. Man, I didn't think the Rays would be this good. I thought they might be a playoff team again, but I didn't think they'd be this good.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. Like, we're having this conversation right now, and usually we're talking about how Steven Stamkos and Nikita Kucherov are going to match up against Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin. But no, we're talking about two first-place teams. And listen, the Rays every year, because they kind of go about things in a different way, and they didn't go out and get a big left-handed bat that they wanted to get. You know, they fly under the radar. They're not going to make big splashes in free agency. And, you know, they're going to be in contention every single year. And last year, the injury bug really hurt them. But this year, for the most part, they've been staying relatively healthy, and what a historic start. Yes, I mean, a lot of people around the country are saying, well, look at the schedule, but they don't make the schedule. It's not like college football where you can schedule a bunch of cream puffs in the first 3 or 4 weeks before you get your conference schedule. I mean, you got to go out there and beat the teams that are in front of you. So the Rays really just firing on all cylinders right now, and how well they're playing is definitely alleviating some of the sadness of the Tampa Bay Lightning getting bounced out in the first round.
Well, at least they've played, what, two series against AL East foes? Because I feel like when you look at Major League Baseball, most of who is good is in Tampa's division. They got the Red Sox and swept them, right? And then actually, I think they lost 2 or 3 to the Blue Jays earlier in the season. So is that where people are focusing on? They've built up most of their wins outside of the AL East? Is that where most of that dialogue is coming from?
Yeah, and I think anytime when you're not a big market team, people are always going to try to poke holes into, you know, your success, whether it be earlier in the season or later on in the season. But, you know, they after the Pirates, they got the Yankees coming to town. So they're going to open up the seats in the upper deck, and there's going to probably be over 20, 25,000, which is just not something that we get very often in Tampa and St. Pete for the Rays. So, hey, you just got to take care of what's going on in front of you. And the AL East is always a dog. But one thing that's really interesting this year with the more balanced schedule is you're not playing the other teams in the AL East as much. So does that hurt the Rays? Does it help the Rays? I mean, public perception, it may hurt the Rays, but down the stretch, I think it may help them. And you look at the division that they're in, you know, not even just the AL East, but any division. I think this is a good thing for the Pirates too. You know, how do big teams blow these leads at the end of the year, like we've seen in the years past, from like when the Mets blew a big lead about a decade ago? Well, it's because they're playing a bunch of interdivision games down the stretch. You're not having that this year. So I think these teams that are getting off to these hot starts, it's going to be easier for them to kind of stave off some of their competition in the division because they're not playing them as much this season.
Rays and Pirates, three-game set starting on Tuesday in Tampa. Tampa 23-6, best record in the major leagues. Pirates right now, at the time of our recording, 20-9 with the best record in the National League. And when you said that the Yankees were coming to town, they're opening up the upper deck, it could be 20,000 to 25,000. I would have thought that even without the Yankees coming in, it would have caught on a little bit more than that, Jay. I get the cynicism and skepticism here. It's also been very cold here. It was like August and March and early April, and now it's become, you know, February again here in Pittsburgh, it feels like. So that's kind of hurt attendance some despite the great start. But it's still something that needs to be sold in Tampa, huh?
Yeah, and it's just because there's just so many different things going on. And I might have been a little light on numbers. It actually might be a little bit more actually for the Yankees now that I think about it, because the attendance has been pretty good. I mean, it's not just because of the hot starts, because they had so many home wins in a row. That really helped them out. And it really, you know, the thing is with Tampa, and I've said this for a long time, it's not that there's a quality of issues, it's just the quantity. There's just so many different things to do. Yes, it's on the other side of the bridge. The majority of the fan base is on the Tampa side. So you have to go over the bridge. That's one thing. There's also a ton of things to do. You know, now as we get closer to the summer, a lot of people that live down here, they go on vacation elsewhere. You know, as far as the amenities to the ballpark, they've been getting better every single year. They got a new big LED board in there. There's more food. There's more options. They have a Randy Land now in left field on Friday nights that you can spend, I think, $40 or $50, go in there, and if Randy or Rosarena hits a home run, you get a free drink and a T-shirt. Like, it's, they're doing everything they can to make it a more appealing option. It's not like Oakland, where Oakland, it was just like they kind of just let that building and that stadium kind of just disintegrate. The Rays are doing the best they can. There's just so many different things that are going on in the Tampa St. Pete area. It's such a burgeoning city, and we do have a lot of people from all over the country. That's something where I think a lot of baseball fans outside of the area, they don't realize. Like, Tim, my radio station, I think there's only one person out of the 10, 12 people that work there that are actually born and raised in Florida. Like, I'm from New York. So it's not a generational thing. Now, 25 years into existence, you're starting to get those Rays fans that, you know, grew up as Rays fans, and now they're having kids. It's just going to take a little while to catch on. But, man, what a great way to start celebrating that 25-year anniversary with the historic March and April that they've had.
Well, it's interesting to hear frame it that way, because I was down in Tampa for the Frozen Four when that was in your city, and we were staying on the Tampa side. And, you know, Friday in between games, they were playing the A's. They were 6-0. I think about, like, let's kill the off day in between by going to a Rays game. And then as the day went along, we're like, oh, do we want to pay the tickets? Oh, do we want to pay the Uber fare? Oh, it's on the other side of the bridge. Like, we did some of that too, and now I'm regretting it. And we also said, this is the A's. Do we really want to see the A's? But we should have gone, because I would have loved to have seen this team now looking back on it and seeing how they've assembled this and put it all together. How have they? I mean, I look up and down the stats, and I'm trying to find a soft spot, and I can't. What stood out the most as far as what they've done well?
It's really a combination of everything. I mean, the first thing they do is that they play fundamental baseball. I mean, pitching, hitting, defense, they've been running the bases. And there's just such a great level of communication between Kevin Cash, his coaching staff, and all the players. I mean, they roll out almost like a different lineup every night. And guys are just always fresh. They're always ready. This isn't a team where they're going to set their nine guys in the lineup. You know it's going to be in night in, night out, and you have your three bench guys. Like, that's not the way the Rays do it. They're interchangeable with everybody. Remember, this is the team that came up with the shift. They came up with the opener. Like, they're always trying to be two steps ahead. And now this year, they have, like, a good amount of elite-level talent to go with it. You have Wander Franco. And I'm telling you, if he stays healthy, he's going to be a top five, top 10 player in baseball. This guy has just got the it factor. He's a switch hitter. Last time I checked, he was top three in extra base hits in all of baseball. You have Randy Rosarena, who had such an amazing postseason 3 years ago, and then he was part of Team Mexico in the World Baseball Classic, arguably one of the biggest stars there. So those two guys have been the cornerstones. And then you look at the pitching. Jeffrey Springs has gone down, unfortunately. He'll be off of the year. But you have Shane McClanahan, who started the All-Star game for the American League last year. He's 5-0. You have Drew Rasmussen, a real under-the-radar type of right-handed pitcher that is just a steady, going to give you 5, 6, 7 innings. Keeping the walks down is the key for him. I mean, he hasn't done the last couple starts, but usually he's really good at that. Zach Eflin was the guy they signed in the offseason. He's a guy that was banged up a little bit. He's back. He's throwing strikes. And then they got this kid, Taj Bradley, that they called up. That was incredible. He looked like a young Chris Archer. They sent him back down. He'll be up soon. And now you're going to get Tyler Glasnow, who I know you guys know well. He'll be back in a couple of weeks. You won't see him this week, but he'll be back, it looks like, 2-3 weeks as he rehabs. So there's just so many different options for this team. They could beat you in so many different ways. And they're not afraid of anybody. And that's they're just such a fun baseball team to watch because you just never know who's going to be the hero.
I'm really looking forward to the Wednesday game when it's Mitch Keller against Shane McClanahan, who you talked about a few moments ago. He's 5-0. His ERA is at 2.12. And I'm thinking, wow, this guy's got Cy Young potential when you look at the start that he's off to. Then again, I see what Shohei's doing. I see what Garrett Cole's doing. Those guys are the ones that get all the attention. Let's hone in on him a little bit more. How good has he truly been in those starts?
Shane, it's so amazing, Tim. I'm glad you asked that because if you look at his record in the first half, in the first five or six starts compared to last year, it's not as like he wasn't 5-0 through five, six starts as he is now, and he still was able to start the All-Star game. He's a guy that's a legit four-pitch pitcher. He's going to run the fastball up into the high 90s, but his changeup to right-handed batters, that's going to be the big key for the Pirates hitters. Can you lay off that changeup? Because when he's throwing the ball 97, 98, the fastball, and then the changeup's coming in at 81, 82, I mean, I've seen some terrible swing and misses. It's just so hard. You got to get your swing going so early when a guy's throwing that hard. And then you mix in the curveball and the slider. This kid is just, he's dynamic. And he's usually when you have a guy like that, he walks a lot of guys. And he's not like that. He attacks the zone. And he doesn't care. He'll get two strikes on you, and he's trying to get you out. He's not trying to have a waste pitch. And it's such a joy to watch. And I think it's going to be cool. I was actually talking about it on my show of, like, what has worked so well for the Pirates. And, you know, looking at don't get to the bullpen, because I love Bednar. I think he's just incredible. I think he's one of the top closers in the league that not enough people know about. And then you look at the starting staff. You look at Keller and Velasquez and a guy like Rich Hill, who we had in Tampa last year. It's kind of funny to see there's some similarities between these two clubs. They play the game the right way. And I think we're in store for an entertaining series. Maybe not one people circled on their calendar when the season started, but there's going to be a lot of eyes in St. Pete on Tropicana Field between these two teams that have played such good baseball to start it off.
Last thing on them, Jay, and then maybe we'll get a Lightning and Bucks thought
sure.
or two from you, but I do want to focus on the sustainability part of this for both teams because that's been the key word in Pittsburgh. How sustainable is it? I mean, they're playing 690 ball right now, right? Mm-hmm. So that's obviously not going to continue. But, you know, if you look at what it took to win the Central last year, the Cardinals won it with 93 wins. That's 575 baseball. You know, to get into the playoffs, like Seattle in the American League got into the playoffs with 90 wins. 90 is 556 baseball. Like, you get 90 wins in Pittsburgh this season, there's going to be a parade whether they get, you know, a round deep or not. People are just going to do backflips. So that's what I think our definition of sustainability is going to be is, can they play well enough to make sure they're above 500, and can they play well enough to at least be a wild card? When you use that phrase, sustainability, with the Rays in this conversation, I don't think they can keep up the pace that they're on right now, but are people framing it from at least win this really good division that they're in?
Yeah, I think that's the most important thing that everybody's kind of kept in mind of, all right, hey, this is an historic start, but they're not going to maintain the same pace, you know, throughout the rest of the season. I think it just all falls back on is just win your series, right? Win two out of three, win three out of four. If you can do that, you'll be one of the teams in the postseason at the end of the year. And the Rays sustained so many injuries last year, and they were still able to make the wild card game against Cleveland. It did end drastically. They only had one run in 24 innings. But I think that's the key. And I look at the Pirates as well. Every division, in my opinion, it has its own unique traits. Like the AL East is the dogs, right? It's like, oh, it's the big, you know, throwing the big money. The Bosses, the New York Torontos. I've always looked at the NL Central of you have those traditional NL Central rivalries. You know, you have the Cubs and the Cardinals and the Pirates and you have the Reds in there. And then the Brewers are like, hey, don't forget about me. And then they go on a stretch. And there's always just good baseball. There's consistency in the NL Central where you're going to have three, four teams. Yeah, you may not have a 105-win team, but Yeah, and you're going to get good baseball. And you're going to get good baseball in May, and you're going to get good baseball in August as well. So I look at the sustainability, and for both of the teams, yeah, it's been a hot start, and maybe they'll come back to the pack a little bit, but as long as you focus on winning series, that's going to be the key. And you can't go on long losing streaks. That's the way you come back to the pack is, you know, can Shea McClanahan and Keller, can those be the two guys that go, hey, yeah, we're on a three-game skid, but I'm going to go out and I'm going to throw seven shutout innings. I'm going to stop it right there. Those will be the keys. It'll be interesting to see, you know, when we have a conversation in a couple of months where both of these teams are at.
Okay, so many thanks to Jay. His Tampa Bay Lightning are out of the NHL playoffs, and so are a bunch of other big-name teams. And boy, did that first round kill me betting-wise. Oof, I took it really in the shorts as a result of that. I had money down on the Bruins, and that killed me. I had Pastrnak as a long-term futures investment to lead the NHL in goal scoring. That obviously isn't going to work out. You know, the NHL postseason to this point, it's sort of living in an NCAA basketball kind of reality right now. Part of the magic and the allure of the NCAA tournament is when the Cinderella teams knock off the top seeds. Everybody loves rooting for the underdog in those scenarios. Until the second weekend when your bracket is busted, and the Sweet 16 is featuring a bunch of players you really don't know from schools that you've never heard of before March Madness even began. This year's tournament was a pretty good example of that, as Purdue was stunned by Fairleigh Dickinson in the first round of Columbus. Now, that resulted in FDU and Florida Atlantic in the second round, which FAU won. Then the Owls proceeded to survive and advance all the way to the Final Four. Not that they weren't deserving. The Owls won four games in a row. No one else in their region did, period, so cut down the nets. But when the gates opened at the Final Four in Houston this year, no one better than a fourth seed was in it. UConn is historically a blue blood, sure, and Miami plays in a big-time conference in the ACC, yet they weren't favored by many to escape their regions. And in the meantime, the other side of the bracket featured San Diego State and FAU. Two strong programs, just not a lot of cachet. Now, according to Sportico, the Final Four CBS television ratings went down 16% from last year's numbers as a result. The NHL may be dealing with some of that same phenomenon this year. Everybody was really engaged in watching the eighth-seeded Panthers shock the Boston Bruins by eliminating them in a seven-game first-round series. After all, the Bruins were the biggest story in hockey entering the postseason, having set the NHL wins and points record in the regular season. And actually, first-round TV ratings were pretty good from what I saw. But now the Bruins are done. Everyone likes to see Goliath fall until they realize he can't get back in the fight for the next round. Similarly, out west, the defending Stanley Cup champion Colorado Avalanche were just upset as the top seed from the Central Division by a second-year expansion franchise in the Seattle Kraken. That's a great story for one round. But now the defending Cup champs are gone, and a franchise that wasn't playing 2 years ago is in round two against Dallas in what could have been an absolute slugfest had the Avs advanced. Maybe it still will be anyway with Seattle playing the Stars instead. I just hope enough people decide to tune in and watch. But I talked to Brian Metzer of the Pittsburgh Penguins Radio Network about all that on the Breakfast with Ben's podcast earlier today. You can listen to it at Trib Live. Just go to the Breakfast with Ben's page and you can click on the podcast link on the lower portion of it. We get into Jacob Trouba's latest controversial hit. We get into a lot surrounding why the Bruins got eliminated in the first place. There's tons of good hockey talk there, but I want to focus here for our purposes on the lines for the upcoming second round series. We'll look at the futures for all four series right now with Brian Metzer, the Pittsburgh Penguins Radio Network. Carolina and the Devils, we just talked a little bit about it. The Devils are actually favored. Even though Carolina has home ice in the series, Devils are a minus 122 favorite to win. Carolina, a plus 104 dog. Do you go with the slight money on Carolina, or do you take the Devils? I'm kind of leaning towards the Devils. How about you?
I'm with you. I think that they are going to be really sparked by their performance in the first round. They look like they're gelling. They have good D. Their defense activates very well. They got that goaltending. If it holds up, that's a big key. The goaltending has to hold up. But Carolina's dealing with still all of those missing pieces. I mean, you got a number of really quality players out of their lineup. I know that the Stanley Cup playoffs is an amazing cure-all,
that they may find a way to get some guys back. But I just feel like maybe based on what we saw, the Devils, I wouldn't be shy about putting a couple bucks on them. Now, if Carolina would win, I don't know that I'd be shocked by it just based on who they are. I think that's going to be a lot of fun to watch that series, though. It's going to be probably back and forth action. And when we talk about coming out parties and guys that kind of made a name for themselves, I think Sebastian Aho, who we all knew was very impressive and one of the best young players in the National Hockey League, he did kind of what Jack Hughes did in round one and kind of put his fingerprints all over that victory and said, you know what, we're almost going to single-handedly launch my team into the second round. But I think Devils probably have what it takes to get past them.
Florida and Toronto, a lot of people presuming that Florida shot its shot already and is now gassed after beating the Bruins in seven. A lot of people presuming that Toronto, now that the Maple Leafs have gotten over the hump of finally advancing beyond the first round, they're moving forward and they've kind of got the monkey off their back and they're going to go to the Stanley Cup Finals. What do you think there? It's minus 182 in favor of Toronto. I think Toronto's going to win, but I bet you it's a 6 or 7 game series.
I think it'd be a six or seven gamer, but I tend to think that yes, they look like a team that could go on a run now, finally getting that demon exercise that everybody keeps talking about. But there's also the matter of I saw reporters feeling the need. I think it was Chris Johnson felt the need to say they just delivered another case of Bud Light to the locker room of the Toronto Maple Leafs as if they were like over celebrating. I don't know that I would have looked at it that way, because think about a case of beer. That's maybe one for everyone. So depending on how many guys were in the room, I mean, I doubt that they had.
Plus, do you have to make it Bud Light right now? Couldn't you pick another brand? I mean, it's Canada. Say Labatt or something at this point and keep the political charges out of it. You know what I mean?
No doubt about it. But you know what's funny about it, Tim, is that we watch Major League Baseball teams take like champagne showers for winning a wild card game. We're going to rip the Toronto Maple Leafs, though, for getting a case of beer after they advance in a 7-game series. So that was kind of ridiculous. But all that said, I think it's not going to be a cakewalk for Toronto. They may win the game or win the series, but I just feel like Florida, they won the President's Trophy last year, and I know their team's a little different. Bobrovsky got a bit of a wake-up call losing his job down the stretch to Alex Lyon. Lyon's bottom fell out in the playoffs. I don't know if you'll have Spencer Knight available at some point in this series, but I think Bobrovsky being, you know, what used to be a very good NHL goaltender, he looked pretty good in the series to clinch it against Boston, and he has a chance now to kind of keep his career on track. Matthew Tkachuk seems like he's on a mission. You got guys like Luostarinen and Verhaeghe coming out of nowhere. The Stahl brothers have been kind of a neat story here, that they're both in the twilight of their career and they have a chance to win together there. Zach Dalpe, who used to follow and unfollow everybody on Twitter that was in the media. I'm sure you got followed by him at one point or another. And I tricked him, because what would happen is he'd follow you and you'd follow him back and then he'd unfollow you. So the last time he followed me, I didn't refollow him, and he still follows me for some reason. So Zach Dalpe is getting his chance. He was a longtime Charlotte Checker, now playing for the Florida Panthers. So when you look at all these things that are going in their direction, I just feel like that's a team that could be primed for a second upset special here. I don't know that they will make it to the Stanley Cup. They may run into some problems if they have to face either Carolina or the Devils in the Eastern Conference Final. But I just, again, it's not a cakewalk for Toronto, and I still don't necessarily believe in Samsonov and goal for Toronto. So I think that could be a story here. It might come down to the goaltending between Bob and him.
Finally, Mets, I had the Stars against the Oilers as my Western Conference final. The Oilers are minus 157 favorite over the Golden Knights. The Knights, with the better record in the regular season, a plus 132 underdog. In the other series, the Stars minus 210, the Kraken a plus 174 dog after winning against the Avalanche. I do think the Oilers and the Stars advance. Boy, I don't like the money in either of those, though. Those are pretty steep odds to pick those two teams. I'd parlay those two together and live with the lower odds and hope for the best.
I think you're onto something there, but I wouldn't be shy about, only because I had a Vegas Golden Knights vibe about Seattle coming into this playoff. They're very deep. They've got scoring on every line. They all of a sudden got some good goaltending in that series. And I feel like maybe their offense could be the difference in the game if they could get to Jake Ottinger. So to get the one, you said it was plus 174. I might take a shot at that and put a couple bucks on them just to go ahead and see what would happen, while at the same time maybe parlaying the other two to still protect yourself, if you know what I'm saying there. So I think that the Edmonton Oilers and the Dallas Stars will be the teams to advance here. Edmonton's really riding a wave. They're really fired up. This is, you know, the Connor McDavid, Leon Draisaitl Express with support. Matthias Ekholm made a huge difference to that team in terms of their ability to defend. Their goaltending has to hold up as well, and I think it probably will with the way they play in front of it. I was surprised, though, to see Vegas do as well as they did in the first round against Winnipeg. Not that it's a surprise that a top seed would beat the second wild card the way that they did, but they did it more impressively than I would have thought. And guys like Jack Eichel are actually performing a little bit. So if he goes up, think about that. No one's talking about it, or maybe they are and I missed it. It's 1 versus 2 in the draft. You always talked about Sid Novy over the years. Eichel gets a chance to show I'm better than Connor for the first time ever and go head-to-head in a playoff series. They were selected 1 and 2 in their draft year. So I think that that adds a little bit more intrigue to that series than maybe people would have thought. But I still think at the end of it, Dallas and Oilers probably advance.
Mets, thanks. Appreciate it. Hey, speaking of Winnipeg, I think Rick Bonus went a little bit more strong against his own guys than we had some volatility in our game from Mike Sullivan after the Penguins got bounced in the regular season. Don't you? Do you see that speech that he gave?
Yeah, Bonus came off. He came off the bench kind of like Trouba with that hit to his team. He caught them square head on like a freight train. And Blake Wheeler didn't like it very much, Tim. He said that, you know, he thought that Bones was wrong. He could have said that to us behind closed doors. And that was the first shot across the bow from Blake Wheeler since he had his captaincy stripped when Bonus took over. And I kind of got a feeling Rick Bonus will be there next year and Blake Wheeler will not. But I was kind of my eyebrows went up when I heard his rant and at what Madden called it. He cut a promo on his team. I think that was the best way to say it.
He did. I'm kind of wondering who the Penguins' next GM is going to be. Speaking of some of the conversations I had with Madden, he made it sound like Dubas has stayed in Toronto, Shiro's going to Philadelphia, and Matthew Darche doesn't want anything to do with Pittsburgh and Tampa. So I don't know who the GM is going to be.
Hey, if you listen to all the bloggers in the city, Eric Tolsky. So we'd have to wait another series before his name bubbles to the surface again, just based on the fact that he and his Carolina Hurricanes are still playing. But I'm waiting for some dark horse candidate. Everybody's throwing out all these, you know, forward-thinking candidates and all these people that they're going to pull as assistant GM there, assistant GM here, blah, blah, blah. And you watch, it'll be like Mike Gillis or something ridiculous. Because don't forget, Mike Gillis put the PowerPoint presentation. It was leaked online and everything back a few years ago whenever they were looking for a GM before. He was lobbying hot and heavy for the job. And I even heard people trying to attach the Penguins to Brad Treliving. So who knows? I think this is wide open still in terms of their search. And it's kind of been quiet in a way. I mean, I expected to hear a little more by now. It's been, what, almost a month since the Penguins have been eliminated, truthfully, if you think about it. And we haven't really got anything.
All right, so my thanks to Mets. My thanks to Jay Retcher from WDAE Radio 2. We will be back next week. We'll talk about the lines as they stand in the NHL playoffs the second round. We'll be halfway through that. We'll also be looking at the Pirates coming off their series against the Toronto Blue Jays. They'll be one game into a series against the Colorado Rockies, a team that they just swept out in Denver not too long ago. So we'll talk to you next week here, the Pittsburgh CityCast, brought to you by Bet Rivers. Download the app or go to BetRivers.com. Bet now from anywhere.
Thanks for listening to the Pittsburgh CityCast on the Bet Rivers Network.